Welcome. I'm Heather Stark. I'm your host for Three Women, Three Ways. We are a show that tackles some tough topics sometimes. And the topic that we're going to be discussing today is with our old friend Barry Goldstein. Barry, welcome to the show.
Good to speak to you again, Heather.
Barry has been very involved in domestic violence, women's issues, sexual assault, and what I like to call just generalized social justice issues, but particularly with some of the topics that we've covered on our show. And he's an expert in so many areas, and I once referred to him as an attorney. He's no longer an attorney. He said, "I'm no longer an attorney. I'm just a nice guy." And I'm here to attest that's the case. He is a nice guy. I'm not sure we need the just in front of it. He's also very knowledgeable. And Barry wrote an article recently that caught my attention, which is why I've asked him to come on the show today. We all know about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and you know, and I don't want to get into a huge political discussion. That's not what this is about. What this is about is what Barry parsed out to be, and rightly so, the U.S. response to sexual abuse and how it favors rapists and offenders. And I think a lot of us have felt that way, but not necessarily verbalized it. Barry, what brought you to this conclusion, to come up with that concise statement, that concise thesis, which I think reflects exactly how many of us feel?
When I was away about a month or two ago, I had a chance to read two books by New York Times reporters. One had to do with Brett Kavanaugh, and the other had to do with Harvey Weinstein. And one of the things I kept noticing when they were talking about Kavanaugh is that his supporters kept saying there's no corroboration, when in fact those of us who were familiar with sexual assault and domestic violence saw overwhelming corroboration. And I noticed that the fundamental difference was they were looking for a witness to the assault. And of course, when we're talking about rape, normally you just have the rapist and the victim. And if they're defining corroboration to require a witness, then rapists will virtually always get away with their crimes, which is exactly what's happening in our country. And so we need to look for other things. You know, sometimes, obviously, there's DNA, but, you know, very often that's not available.
And I think that when, you know, this hinging everything on corroboration, what you pointed out, obviously, is very true. This is a private crime. This is a crime that occurs without witnesses. But when it does have witnesses, you're talking about the fraternity brothers, or you're talking about people who will not come forward to corroborate, even if they did see a crime commit. So requiring corroboration, I thought that went out the window decades ago. And yet it's still there, isn't it? That sense that somebody has to have seen it. Somebody has to, you can't just take the woman's word for it. You just can't trust these women. You can't take their word for it. Clearly, we have to have somebody else who saw it who can say, yes, this did happen, or yes, this was a bad thing, or a crime, or a violent thing. Didn't we get rid of all that years ago?
Well, you know, there was a time when women weren't allowed to testify about someone raping them. And we're not much past that today. But, you know, just to be clear, you know, particularly in the context of a crime, you know, you have to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. And, you know, if you have, you know, the rapist says, "I didn't do it," and the victim says he did, that may not eliminate a reasonable doubt. But very often there's other kinds of evidence that experts understand is strong corroboration, but society and the court system are not used to thinking of it in those ways.
Yeah. How do we deal with that? I mean, how do the courts deal with that when almost every other crime has to have some sort of corroboration, some sort of witness, even though the studies show witnesses are highly unreliable anyway, but it seems like so many court cases are hinged on that. But then we come here where it's a not visible crime except to the parties that are involved in it. How do the courts deal with that?
Well, as you know, in my article, I gave two personal examples of cases I was involved in where it was one-on-one and there was no problem in one case getting a conviction and in the other getting an order of protection. So it is possible from the context, from, you know, the demeanor of the witness, et cetera, to have strong evidence. Another thing that I think prosecutors should do much more often is to use expert witnesses, because very often normal responses from victims are misunderstood by the jury. And so, you know, lots of times true reports can be disbelieved. And of course, the biggest problem, as you mentioned, is that there is this myth that women frequently make false reports, and that's just not true.
No. The studies that I've read and the studies that are commonly referred to show that some people lie. You know, I mean, whether they're male or female, sometimes people lie. But the studies are pretty consistent in saying that's probably less than 2%, and it's the same for men and for women about lying or making false reports. So the notion that somehow or other we have to automatically assume that any report by a woman is false, it's been disproven. It's been disproven by the research. And yet, I think that prejudice, isn't there?
Heather, I would say something different. Absolutely, women, you know, when it comes to abuse issues, rarely lie. That's not as true about men. And I think there's two points that I would make that I think are really important. The first is, it is far more common for an offender to lie about his assault for obvious reasons, and yet we tend to give, you know, the alleged criminal, even when there's strong evidence or even a past history, we are much less skeptical of the offender than of the victim. And the other thing, which applies more to domestic violence and child custody, is that in the context of contested custody cases, the Ballas study found that fathers were 16 times more likely to make deliberate false reports than the mothers. And again, that's something that even professionals who ought to be familiar with that don't. And so you have a situation where professionals are more skeptical about reports by women that are rarely false than about reports by men that are much more likely to be false.
Yeah. Which report did you say that was? Who did that report?
That's the Ballas study, and it was cited repeatedly in the Saunders study.
Okay, yeah, all right. Okay, I'm going to check that out. So what we're dealing with, and you know, years ago, Barry, I used to do a lot of talks about the courts and to just community groups and, you know, sometimes groups of psychologists. And I would always say that, you know, it seems to me as a layperson that the courts operate under three principles. One is that every father has to be in every child's life for that child's well-being. That even if a father hurts the mother, that doesn't impact the child, and so fathers have a right to that, to their property, i.e. the child. And the third premise they seem to operate under is she lies. She lies. it just seems to be endemic. And I think that's a cultural thing, isn't it? I mean, don't we? I mean, I've been to parties where the assumption is that whatever the woman says is just kind of fudged or a lie or a stretch of the truth. I think that our culture just kind of, it's one of those little hidden prejudices that we don't talk about a lot, I think. Am I off base here, or do you see that as well?
No, I would agree with everything you say. You know, certainly we live in a sexist society. And the other thing, which is a broader part of the problem, is that because we're in a sexist society, when women speak, people tend to focus more on their dress, their appearance, their beauty, their body parts. And to the extent that they're doing that, they're not focusing on the substance of what they're saying. And that gives men a huge unearned advantage over women, even in situations that have nothing to do with, you know, sexual assault or domestic violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when it comes to sexual assault or domestic violence, I mean, it's the repercussions of that are so much stronger.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, the harm from domestic violence and sexual assault is far greater than I think we understand, and really, you know, holds back our society in horrific ways. I mean, there's a bigger story, for instance, the life expectancy in the United States has been going up for, you know, probably 100 and more years, and recently that stopped. And, you know, I heard various explanations that are probably part of the explanation, but the fact is, if we paid more attention to preventing sexual assault and child abuse and domestic violence, that life expectancy would go up, you know, probably at least a few years. And, you know, we would save an enormous amount of money in terms of health care costs.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's hard to document these things, isn't it?
I mean, I think the problem is that we tend to want to look at each case separately and we miss the patterns. One of the reasons that domestic violence professionals and sexual abuse experts have that expertise is that they look for patterns and they see things that are going on, you know, in across the board, and it makes it easier for them to recognize. Whereas legal professionals are taught to look at each issue, each case separately, and they're missing the patterns. And so very often we find courts making decisions or findings that are extremely rare. And they could be right in an individual case, but you could not possibly have these rare occurrences as often as the courts are finding them, which tells us that the courts are using really flawed practices and that the flawed practices are helping rapists and helping domestic violence offenders and hurting women and children.
You make an argument about how the court, and I'm not sure if this is a constitutional thing or not, but the presumption of innocence in criminal cases. How did that presumption of innocence develop? How did we get there? And why is that something we need to be looking at in sexual assault cases?
Well, you know, fundamental constitutional right is that you shouldn't be put in jail unless they can prove a crime beyond a reasonable doubt, you know, that you have a presumption of innocence. And that's really important to our way of government, you know, because obviously there are countries that don't believe in that, and the violations are really horrific. One of the things that goes wrong, though, is that very routinely we apply the same criminal standards to civil cases. In other words, you want to err on the side of keeping an innocent person out of jail, and so you require a higher standard of proof before you convict someone of a crime. But if you're talking about should that person have a protective order, you know, to limit him from hurting his victim again, or if we're talking about should that person have child custody, you don't want to err on the side of risking children or risking the lives of partners. You want to err on the side of protecting them. And very often we miss that. One of the things I found really interesting in the book about Kavanaugh is it quoted Senator Susan Collins, and she said Kavanaugh is entitled to the presumption of innocence. And that sounded so reasonable, I don't think anyone challenged it, including in the book. But what I saw is, if he was on trial for the rape that he allegedly committed, then absolutely he's entitled to a presumption of innocence. But if he's in a job interview to determine whether he should be on the Supreme Court, you know, if there's some chance that he committed a crime like that, he should not be considered. The presumption should be in the other direction. You know, he has no constitutional right to be a Supreme Court justice. There are, you know, many other men and women who are at least disqualified who are not potential sex offenders. We can do better because the Supreme Court justice should be based on what's best for the country, not based on some right that Kavanaugh has. He has no right to be on the Supreme Court. And that was never discussed.
Yeah. I think that, you know, we see this a lot, excuse me, where we have this these rules that apply that seem to defy logic. I'm thinking of child custody, for example. I've had a family court judge say directly to me that, you know, in cases in family court of custody, if the abuser is well put together and under control and the woman is kind of frantic and can't even pull herself together, those were the terms that were used for me, then, of course, if the domestic violence isn't that bad, we're going to give custody to the father. I just am gobsmacked by that.
I haven't heard a judge say that. I've heard judges do that very frequently. And interestingly,
a Denver family court judge said that to me when I was interviewing her for the show. She did not say it on air. She said it off air. But she said that directly to me.
Well, the Saunders study specifically found that courts are placing way too much importance on mothers' anger and emotion, all out of proportion to what it says about their parenting ability. And this is one very common example of gender bias, you know, because it's based on gender myths and stereotypes.
Well, and when you were talking earlier about, you know, placing the victim, when you were saying that it needs to be placed in context and the demeanor of the witnesses, et cetera, I get nervous when we talk about demeanor because we see that so often in domestic violence cases where the woman is either terrified out of her mind, or if she's not terrified out of her mind and she comes across as cool and collected, then there's something wrong with her because she's cool and collected under these circumstances. That whole notion of judging demeanor is a little slippery for me. But you think that, I mean, you make the argument that it should be considered.
Well, remember, you know, I also said that we should have experts testify because experts can explain, you know, the reactions. Just one common example is that when children are repeatedly interviewed about reports of child sexual abuse, after a while, they, talk in a rote way. That's sort of a normal response, and uneducated professionals often treat that as proof that they were coached, and an expert could explain that. One of the stories I told in this article was about a 15-year-old girl whose father had sexually abused her, and her mother was seeking a protective order for her, and she told her story of what the father did and how it impacted her. And when she was finished, the judge, and I can tell you that judge was not, a pro-feminist kind of judge. He usually ruled the wrong way. But when she finished testifying, the judge said, "There is no way we're going to leave without you having a protective order." I mean, the emotion, the feelings, et cetera, there was no way that could have been made up.
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem with that, though, and I'm glad, that the judge was sensitive enough to get that, but the problem with that is what if you have a person whose demeanor, who doesn't handle stress in that way, she handles it by shutting down. And then you've got a judge who thinks, well, she wasn't that impacted by it, so clearly it wasn't that big of a deal. And, I'm playing a little bit of devil's advocate here, but, that whole notion of, I don't think that we should disregard demeanor, but I worry that it's a little slippery for people, as you said, who are making the decisions, who are not experts, and who might not recognize that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why you would call an expert to explain, if you have a witness, the witness or the victim who is reacting that way, it makes it really important to bring on an expert witness who can be asked about the victim's reaction.
Yeah. The problem with the, and I'm playing devil's advocate here. I'm not challenging you. I'm just trying to get more information out. The problem with those experts is that not all the experts are particularly expert. Do you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. But what that really goes to, which is based on Saunders, is that I'm talking about experts in domestic violence, experts in child sexual abuse, and what the courts are used to using are experts in psychology and mental illness who rarely also have expertise in domestic violence or child sexual abuse. So it is very common, as you're suggesting, that courts, particularly in child custody cases, are using the wrong experts.
Yeah. So would that be a problem? I mean, how can you make the courts get the right experts?
Well, Heather, keep in mind, we're jumping around to different cases. We were talking about custody, talking about rape, we're talking about criminal, and so there are different standards and, different things that you need to do. The biggest problem in terms of experts is in the child custody field, where what happened, 30, 40 years ago when domestic violence first became a public issue, as you've heard me say many times, there was no research, and the courts used popular assumptions that domestic violence was caused by mental illness or substance abuse, and they turned to mental health professionals. And these people have expertise in some areas that are helpful. They are not experts in domestic violence. They are not experts in child sexual abuse, and that's why so often they get those wrong. I mean, I've read so many, evaluations where the evaluator, acting in perfect good faith, talks a little bit about the alleged domestic violence, can't figure it out because they have no expertise, don't know what to look for, and focuses on other less important issues. And, so you don't get, so what happens is domestic violence is minimized and denied, and the children aren't protected. But I think we're, in terms of using the expert witnesses, we were talking really about criminal cases where a victim's demeanor or, what's corroboration isn't understood by the general public or even professionals who are an expert in that, and an expert witness could be really helpful.
in the sexual assault cases, who are the experts? Who could the judges call as expert witnesses?
You know, people in rape crisis centers, people who do, you know, forensics and interviews and stuff like that, but who focus on victims of child sexual abuse.
No. Yeah. Why do you, well, no, I'm going to go back to your article here a little bit because you're right, we're wandering. And, you know, that's how my mind is working today. I'm very random today, so bear with me if you would. One of the things that I want to talk about is why the connection between lack of reporting the crime of sexual assault and sexual abuse and our social attitude toward it and the way the courts handle it. This is a problem, is it not? I mean, we hear about women and children, so many who are assaulted, and yet they never report, they never get any kind of treatment, they just carry that with them forever, there's never any kind of justice. There are some people that I've actually talked to who say that's not a bad thing. You just, why do you have to do all this stuff? Why do you have to trot it out? Why do you have to talk about it? Just put it away and move on. And yet, that's not really advisable, is it?
Well, we're talking about two separate things. One is, you know, an individual victim has to understand or has to think about what's best for her in recovering. And what's best for her may or may not be what's best for society. And, you know, we have to understand that. I mean, the woman who's been raped, you know, is traumatized, is, you know, continues to be in some danger. And, you know, she needs to figure out the best way to recover. But society, when they develop policies and practices, needs to figure out how to discourage these heinous crimes. And we are doing a really horrible job. We're doing a horrible job of preventing the rape and sexual assault of women, and we're doing a horrible job in preventing sexual assault of children. And that really ought to be a much greater priority. You know, there are a few things that are more important in our society than preventing that, and we can. And I think part of what I was saying in the article is that when law enforcement and lawyers and judges tend to disbelieve victims, when we have a system where, you know, almost every rapist gets away with it, that encourages men to continue committing rape because there's a good chance they'll get away with it, and it discourages victims from reporting because, you know, they often will be re-traumatized by, you know, the official response to their reports. And it also, of course, means that the rapists are on the street and available to harm still more people. So we need to change that.
Yeah. Changing courts, saying it is very easy, but it's not an easy thing to do, is it? Courts seem to be particularly entrenched in the way they operate, the ways they operate. But you mentioned that there are some court districts, some jurisdictions, that have actually created gender bias committees. How often, how frequent is that? I mean, that's really hopeful to me. Can you talk more about the gender bias committees that some court districts are working with now?
Yes, and it's, the good news is it's very widespread, and the bad news is it hasn't made a big difference. 40 states and many judicial districts have created, and listen to this, court-sponsored gender bias committees. So this is the courts trying to do this. And this started like in the 80s and has continued on. And they have found widespread bias against women. And one of the things that's so difficult about gender bias is it's, for the most part, it's not intentional. It's often subconscious. It's often based on myths and stereotypes. And so the people who are doing it, which includes women, don't realize they're doing it. But if you were to tell a judge, hey, you know, what you just said or did is, you know, biased against women, you know, you're endangering yourself because there's a, you know, you're going to get a defensive reaction and quite possibly retaliation, which means that attorneys and litigants are afraid to raise the issue. And, you know, the courts have not responded to these findings by creating training and, you know, trying to encourage reports. And so we really haven't made any progress. And the new study that I know you're familiar with by Joan Meyer confirms that we have made very little progress with respect to gender bias. And it gives men a huge advantage. And I suppose, you know, considering that there's so much bias against women just in our society in all parts, not surprising that there'd be gender bias in the courts.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. It's so endemic, and oftentimes people don't see it. Sometimes I don't see it, and I think I'm pretty aware of these things. But it's just so, you know, when you talk about these committees being in effect in some places since the 80s, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Do you think, and this is a bit of an aside, if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine, but do you think the hashtag MeToo movement had any impact in moving some of this the way things are done here?
I think it's been helpful. I think it hasn't been enough. You know, I mean, think about it. There have been, you know, scandals and, you know, attempts to deal with things like the Catholic Church sex scandal, the Boy Scouts, the Olympic athletes, sex assaults in the military, on college campuses. And the Me Too movement, to me, is part of that broader pattern. What I haven't seen yet and what I keep waiting for is, when are we going to say that it's not acceptable for a quarter of our children to be sexually assaulted? And when are we going to deal with the problems in the custody court system? And I think all of the things I just mentioned are interconnected. They're all based on, you know, gendered crimes that overwhelmingly are committed against women and children. And we need to take all of these things far more seriously, which I think is really the thrust of my article. And I think we need to talk about this and start thinking about doing something. You know, and, you know, the court system, for the most part, doesn't even know there's a problem. You know, we know it's a problem. You know, I appreciate your inviting me on your show because it's a chance to talk about this and hopefully get someone to notice who can do something about it, that this ought to be intolerable. And I think when I have a list of ideas of how to change this, and the first thing is that we really have to take these crimes more seriously, make it a priority to prevent it. And that ought to be, you know, 100-0. You know, who wants to support rapists and abusers? But right now, they're the ones that are favored. Why are we doing that?
Yeah, it's an amazing dynamic. You will have people say, well, because of this assumption of false reporting. And that's a very strong, I mean, I speak with a lot of men about things, and they really do. They kind of think, well, you know, yeah, she said this, but. And I don't know whether it's a defensive mechanism, because these are men who would not, you know, are not committing gendered crimes. They're not men who would support rapists. And yet there's that little thing in their brains that, yeah, well, she just said that for either some sort of control or some sort of power or some sort of vindictiveness or whatever. I'm always kind of shocked by how there's that little kernel in their brains that would be the case, that somehow or other this woman would just be saying it just because, for whatever reason. And yet it's there. I see it. So we do operate, I think, normal folks who don't, who are not normally exposed to the courts, who are not normally involved in sexual assault or gendered violence, there's still that little kernel of, well, you kind of have to question this. And I don't know how you get past that. I mean, courts can have gendered bias committees that look at things, and we can come up with studies. And you know, but how do you get past that little kernel that seems to be in so many men's brains, and maybe women's too? I've noticed it more in the men that I've spoken with. How do you get past that?
Well, you know, you and I have talked about some communities that develop responses to prevent domestic violence. And basically what they did is they took it more seriously, and they were successful, and they reduced the crime, and best of all, they reduced the murders. So we know that it can be done. But what was interesting in those communities is that there was always one or a group of leaders who helped bring that program to fruition and, you know, got it moving. And I think we need, you know, leadership. I mean, you know, right now, you know, we're getting ready for a presidential election, and there's, you know, there's a million of other issues, probably not a lot of issues more basic than, you know, let's stop domestic violence and sexual assault. And, you know, what would happen if one of the candidates suddenly said, hey, that's going to be a priority for me?
Do you think he would get elected? He or she would get elected if that was what they were running on as one of their primary things? Do you think our culture would go yay, or do you think the bulk of the voters would kind of go yeah, whatever, you know?
Well, I mean, obviously you can't just say it. You need to have something backing it up and all of that. But I mean, if it was presented in a good way, I think it would be a plus. I mean, nobody can say, hey, I'm in favor of rapists.
Yeah.
You know, what would really be good is if by one starting it, that all the other candidates felt the need to have their own programs to stop this. And so we really had a discussion about what is a really important issue.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a difference between, and I'm talking, and again, this is a random question. For some reason, my brain is working randomly today. And if you don't have an opinion about it, just that's fine. But do you see a difference in our female candidates and our male candidates when it comes to these kinds of issues? Is there a huge divide there, or are you seeing women standing up and waving the banner for change required in some of these areas and not men, or is it 50-50? What is your observation when you're looking at the people who are running for national political office right now?
Well, you know, Heather, I actually am working on another article about my history. And, you know, I grew up, obviously, in a sexist society, and I had the same beliefs and biases that most guys did. Not much more, not much less, just, you know, I had typical sexist beliefs, you know, and I think it's fair to say that those beliefs were normal. And when I first got on the board of a battered women's shelter, you know, what I started to do was to keep my mouth shut and to listen to women. And that's the only way I got more smart. And it's something, you know, the point is, I think, that women have much more experience of what it's like to live in a sexist society. It impacts their lives in ways that men can be oblivious to. And so I think women candidates are more likely to recognize the problem, to have a sense of, you know, not minimizing the harm that this does. And certainly there are male candidates that are supportive, you know, but I think it's there is a difference, because men don't live in a society where they have to think about where they're going to go, what they're going to do in terms of, do they have to guard against being sexually assaulted? And that makes a big difference. And, you know, men just don't think of it in those terms.
Yeah, they don't. I remember talking with my son years ago about the common practice of women getting up and going to the bathroom at the same time. You'd be in a restaurant or you'd be at a party, and two women would say, "I'm going to the restroom," boom, and they two would go. And my son, who was a young teenager at the time, said, "That's so creepy. Why do girls always go to the bathroom together?" And I said, "Well, the basic cause is because, you know, that assumption that you're not necessarily safe going by yourself. That's just kind of an underlying, even if you don't verbalize it, even if you don't think about it, that's kind of the underlying message that we give young girls. You know, don't go here by yourself. Don't go there by yourself." And having raised a daughter, I said the same thing. You know, I don't want my daughter. Of course, I didn't want my son out, you know, on First Avenue in the middle of the night either, you know. So, I mean, I wasn't that different in my expectations for my two children. But the assumption, as you're pointing out, women have to do things differently. And it's bred into us from, you know, toddlerhood. And it's all based on that safety assumption, I think. And men don't see that. Men aren't raised that way. Men don't worry about, oh gosh, something could happen to me if I'm going to the bar alone, you know. And you know, I mean, it's a little bit different now, but than it was years ago. But it's still there. It's still there. Women tend to go more places in groups or in pairs. And I think that, you know, the etiology of that is that, you know, the safety issue of not being a woman alone. So, yeah, men don't get that. They've never had that.
And
that's just one example.
If something happens to, I don't want to say that, if a man assaults a woman, right away the issue is, what did she do wrong? What's wrong with her? Instead of,
yep,
what's wrong with the assaulter.
Yeah, exactly. You know, why was she there? You know, why was she wearing that? We don't hear that so much anymore, the why was she wearing that, you know. But, yeah, it's just, it always comes back to that. And so your notion that, you know, the expectations and the way of living for women is different than it is for men, just based on safety issues. And men oftentimes don't get it. They haven't been raised that way. And again, that's just one small example of the differences. So, you know, I mean, it's obvious why we should be having these issues. I mean, men are the ones who still, you know, for a large part, control the courts and the court systems. And, you know, if they don't see the need for some sort of behavior, it just seems random and odd to them, then they're going to rule or think or argue against a certain way and not get it. Which comes back to your whole idea of getting, you know, getting courts aware. And I really wish there was something that we could all do about that. You know, one of my big issues is when many areas we vote for judges, and most of us do not have a clue about the qualifications for that judge. I mean, we see the recommendations of the bar associations, and we see, you know, that all that kind of stuff. But that doesn't tell us how this judge behaves on the bench or his assumptions about the people who come before him on the bench. I wish there was some way that we could bring that out so that voters who have to vote for judges have a real basis for understanding who they're voting for or voting, you know, not voting for. And I think this is an area where that would be really helpful. You know, is this guy a misogynist? Is this guy somebody who gets it a little bit? You know, where can we find out about that stuff, you know, when we're faced with having to vote for a decision maker like this? I guess we could apply that to everything that we get to vote on. Again, being random here. You know, Barry, I think it's important because we've been talking a lot about what's happening. I think it's important that we talk about why it's important to solve this. And then I want to spend a few minutes because you came up with some ideas in your article about how it could be solved. So, but let's take a few minutes to talk about why this is so significant. We know 25% of our children will be sexually assaulted. And nobody talks too much about that. What are some of the other reasons that people need to hear for why this is an important issue that we're talking about today?
You know, it certainly means many women never reach their full potential because of sexual assault or domestic violence. And that's a huge loss to our society. And, you know, we don't know what we're missing, so it doesn't get considered. You know, the biggest reason, and, you know, so often, you know, I wind up having the right stories, you know, of just horrific tragedies, or I'm, you know, working with women in the custody cases who have been horrifically mistreated by their abusers, and then the courts mistreat them again. And, you know, the pain and the suffering that women go through and children go through because we're doing such a poor job, you know, it's really horrendous. You know, there's, you know, I keep trying to find words to describe it. And as a man, it's a lot harder to help others understand, you know. You know, I sometimes in the batterer class, we do, you know, it's like a line, of a continuum of respectful behavior all the way to domestic violence. And, you know, we like to say that you can't go any further in terms of the worst abuse being murder, and rape is, you know, near that. And, you know, I am aware in my mind that for some victims, rape is worse than murder. And I, you know, couldn't possibly make, you know, a case for one way or the other. Only the victim can. But I think that says something about just how horrible the experience is. And I think it's something that we're missing.
Yeah. You know, your point about losing that potential. You know, I don't talk about it very much, but I've had, you know, my share of stuff that I've had to live through. And I think I'm doing very well. And I think I'm content with my life. I think I'm doing as much as I can do. I hope to do more. And I'm working toward doing more. But every now and then, a little part of my brain thinks, if I hadn't had this, what could I have been? What could I have done? That
comment makes,
you know, really resonates with me, Barry. You know, the lost potential of women who have experienced these kinds of things. It's huge.
You know, there's an episode of MASH where a sergeant comes in who's really racist, and he says, you know, don't give me the wrong kind of blood. He's afraid that he's going to turn into a black person. And the doctors decide to teach him a lesson in a good way, and they put something on his skin that he wakes up black and, it, you know, learns something. And they explain that the reason they did that was that there was a black doctor who invented the procedure to separate plasma, and it was a procedure that, you know, saved millions of lives. And, you know, he was in an accident, and, they took him to a hospital that was for whites only, and they wouldn't treat him, so they had to get him to a black hospital, and by that time he died. And here was someone who already had invented a process to save millions of lives. Who knows what else he might have done if he had lived? And that's the kind of thing that we're missing, and we can't imagine it in big and small ways.
Yeah, it's huge. It's huge. That lost potential, and lost for what reason, you know? I mean, it's one thing if, you know, there's some global reason that you have to go through some sort of trauma or hardship, but it's another thing if you have to do it because of somebody's criminal behavior or selfish behavior, I guess. Anyway, yeah, I think that's huge. We need to solve this problem, Barry. And you've talked about ways we might approach some solutions to this. Could you share some of those with us?
Well, I mean, some of the things we've talked about, you know, we need to make it a priority. You know, certainly prosecutors, you know, we see how they, lots of times the rape kits aren't used. Lots of times police and prosecutors will interview victims in ways that discourages reports. And, you know, we need to stop doing that. You know, we've sometimes talked about the Quincy solution, which had a bunch of good practices to prevent domestic violence. One of the things they did was a special office in the prosecutor's office to prosecute child sexual abuse crimes, particularly incest. Because today, our society only treats sexual abuse of children seriously when it's committed by a stranger. And when it's committed by someone who the child knows, particularly a close relative, the courts are using reunification rather than prosecution and protecting the child. And that's one of the big problems within the, you know, custody court system. We, you know, obviously we need, you know, laws to take things seriously. We need to think about criminal protections not applying to non-criminal cases or situations. You know, the protections for a defendant don't apply to the criminal justice system. They don't apply to the general public. So if your next door neighbor is charged with sexually abusing children, you don't have to say, well, he's innocent until proven guilty, so I'm going to let my children play there. We wouldn't think of doing that, but that's kind of the attitude, you know, it's pretty common. So, I mean, those are some, but I think the biggest thing is we need some leadership, and we need both federally and locally to make this a priority, you know, to really be just as... There have been campaigns against sexual assault in the military, sexual assault on college campuses. We need to broaden that it ought to be a priority in this country to prevent sexual assault and to prevent domestic violence. And I think one of the things I talked about in the article was the media, you know, both how they portray sexual assault and domestic violence, and they sort of sensationalize the crime, and they don't focus on what the aftermath is, which, you know, would be much better in terms of learning about it. But that one of the things I would like to see is, commercials, where you provide free commercials, to help society. And just as the insurance industry has their own commercials about how we pay for insurance fraud, and of course they have an interest in doing that, we should talk about the fact that we all pay for allowing rapists and abusers to get away with their crimes. The fact is that the United States spends over $1 trillion to allow men to abuse their partners, and if we added sexual assault, it would probably be a few $1 trillion. That's going to be like several $1,000s a year for each person. I'm sure we can all do a lot better things with it than let rapists and abusers commit their crimes. And obviously it's not realistic to eliminate it totally, but we could substantially reduce it and save a big chunk of money that could be used for so many better things and to educate the public about how common it is for rapists and abusers to get away with their crimes and that that's not inevitable, I think would be helpful. And what we also have to, teach people is that, the myth that women and children frequently make false reports really contributes to the tolerance for rape and sexual assault.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the other things that you mentioned, which I found interesting, is statutes of limitations. Our state just recently passed a change in the statute of limitations for child sexual assault and expanded that, which was wonderful. But a lot of states still have statutes of limitations that limits both civil and criminal consequences for sexual abuse cases. How common is that, and how big of a problem is that statute of limitations issue?
Heather, as you know, I work with the Stop Abuse Campaign, and statute of limitation reform has been one of their leading causes. And we're based in New York, and New York is one state that also recently passed that. And it's really important because it's not just that victims can collect money from abusers. It's also that typically child victims have difficulty remembering and, talking about it until decades later. And so when we artificially limit, lawsuits, it means that sexual assaulters, rapists, are more likely to get away with their crimes and therefore more likely to commit them. And that's really, important. And, of course, it undermines the message we're trying to send, that this is not taught to be tolerated.
So it's crucial to try and get legislators to back up the notion of changing the statutes of limitation. And again, I think that all goes back to, the compelling case that you made for getting experts involved, people who work with this, people who see this, people who understand it. Know that sometimes it takes years to process this before people can go ahead. So we need to get more information out there. We need to get the experts who understand this out there, and we need to communicate. But I guess we could say that about just about everything, couldn't we, Barry? I'm looking at our clock, and I'm going, gosh, no. If you are interested, and I hope you are, in reading the article that Barry wrote, Barry, how do they access that article, The U.S. Response to Sexual Abuse Favors Rapists?
Well, you can find it at the Stop Abuse Campaign on the blog. You can find it there. I posted it on some of my Facebook pages, which would include the NOMAS pages and Stop Abuse Campaign Action Committee, and my personal Facebook page. So I think you'll be able to find it.
Okay, stopabusecampaign.org, and it's right there. And I always go there. They have some wonderful information. Barry, thank you so much for coming on again and talking with me. Sorry, I was kind of all over the board today. It's one of those days for me. But you you held us together admirably. Thank you for the work you do, and thank you for being on the show with us on Three Women, Three Ways. Until next time.